her known and not so well-known music. I hope you'll join me Monday, November 5th, from 2 to 4. Let's celebrate Joni's birthday together.
You are tuned into KBOO Community Radio. The time is 5:59. KBOO Community Radio, member-supported, community-driven. You a member? Thank you. You're not a member? It's time. Go to kboo.fm. We have that donate button right there on the top of our homepage. So easy to become a member today. When you become a member of KBOO, you become an active listener. You become a part of being a media maker and supporting those who make the media. So become a member today, kboo.fm. Community supported radio, you love it. That's why you are tuned in. Stay tuned for Bread and Roses coming up in just a minute. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO members and support from the League of Women Voters Portland, providing unbiased election information online, featuring a personalized guide, including candidate answers to questions, explanations of ballot measures, and links to recorded candidate interviews and nonpartisan voter forums. More information at vote411.org. Coming up next is a special presentation of Rising Up with Sonali in place of Bread and Roses for tonight.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, Senator Cory Booker and former National Intelligence Director James Clapper are the latest targets of the pipe bomber who has been sending suspicious packages to many of President Donald Trump's favorite political targets. The packages addressed to Booker in New Jersey was discovered in Florida on Friday morning and the one sent to Clapper was found at a mail sorting facility in New York. This now brings to 12 the total number of such pieces of mail found this week. The FBI is engaged in a nationwide manhunt for the perpetrator. It isn't yet clear if the intention was to actually cause damage or to simply sow fear. Authorities have traced the mail back to a U.S. mail distribution center at Opa-locka, northwest of Miami in Miami-Dade County, Florida. According to Reuters, authorities called the parcel bombs an act of terrorism. They were sent less than 2 weeks before national elections that could alter the balance of power in Washington. Larry Johnson, former head of criminal investigations for the Secret Service, spoke with Associated Press and said,
"It looks like it's someone making a statement that, guess what, I can send letters to prominent people all at the same time and bring some type of focus to my cause. Whether we know what that cause is or not currently, I think eventually we'll find that out."
That's Larry Johnson, former head of criminal investigations for the Secret Service. On Thursday, California Representative Maxine Waters, who is one of the recipients of the suspicious mail, issued a video response.
"I don't know whether the bombs are real or not, but we should not crawl under the bed, close the doors, not go out, be afraid to go to rallies, whatever. We have to keep doing what we're doing in order to make this country right. That's what I intend to do. And as the young people said, I ain't scared."
That's Representative Maxine Waters, a frequent critic of Trump and an even more frequent target of Trump's attacks, responding to the pipe bomb packages. Trump has dug in his heels and refused to tone down his angry rhetoric, saying on Twitter on Friday, "Funny how lowly related CNN and others can criticize me at will, even blaming me for the current spate of bombs and ridiculously comparing this to September 11th and the Oklahoma City bombing. Yet when I criticize them, they go wild and scream, it's just not presidential." Later on our show today, we'll turn to Julie Milliken of Media Matters for America to discuss just how seriously Trump has encouraged violence over the past several years and how the right-wing media are determined to blame the left for what has happened. In other news, a 51-year-old white man named Gregory Bush has been arrested in Louisville, Kentucky, for the murder of two African Americans, 69-year-old Vicki Lee Jones and 67-year-old Maurice Stallard, in a supermarket. Bush was charged on Thursday with 2 counts of murder and 11 counts of wanton endangerment. According to the New York Times, surveillance video had recorded Mr. Bush's unsuccessful attempt to enter the nearby First Baptist Church of Jeffersontown shortly before the attack. Journalist Sean King, who has been closely following the story, wrote in The Intercept, "When Ed Harrell, a white man in the parking lot, saw Bush coming toward him, he pulled out his own revolver and yelled to ask what was going on. According to Harrell, Bush replied, 'Don't shoot me, I won't shoot you. Whites don't shoot whites.'" King wrote, "It was racism. These killings were hate crimes. Saying otherwise is not only an insult to the victims and their families, but to the entire black community of Louisville, which is reeling right now from this." Caitlyn Jenner has written an op-ed in the Washington Post, taking back her support for Trump. The prominent transgender celebrity and author had backed Trump in the early days of his presidency, despite strong evidence showing he was likely to undo the rights of LGBTQ Americans. On Thursday, Jenner wrote, "I thought Trump would help trans people. I was wrong." She explained, "I believed I could work within the party and the Trump administration to shift the minds of those who most needed shifting. But the reality is that the trans community is being relentlessly attacked by this president. The leader of our nation has shown no regard for an already marginalized and struggling community. He has ignored our humanity. He has insulted our dignity." Jenner's op-ed comes a day after the Justice Department filed a brief with the U.S. Supreme Court saying that transgender workers are not protected by the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and several days after it was revealed that Trump intended to remove Title IX protections for transgender people. Trump on Thursday announced a plan to lower prescription drug prices for some Americans. The plan would slowly shift the prices of drugs for Medicare recipients to the same level as the international market. It would not apply to medication bought at the drugstore, only given at doctor's offices, such as cancer treatments. President Trump, in a speech at the Department of Health and Human Services, in his usual manner of exaggerating his achievements, touted the plan as far more important than it is and cast it in nationalist terms.
"Today, the United States will finally begin to confront one of the most unfair practices, almost unimaginable that it hasn't been taken care of long before this, that drives up the cost of medicine in the United States. In other words, Americans pay more so that other countries can pay less. Very simple. That's exactly what it is.
That's President Trump speaking on Thursday about a complex plan that he has proposed to drive down the costs of a very narrow set of drugs. According to Associated Press, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi of California said if Trump wants to save seniors money, he should seek congressional approval for Medicare to negotiate prices for its main prescription drug program, Part D. In news from the caravan of asylum seekers heading to the U.S. from Central America, there are now reports that Trump is considering a plan to close the U.S. southern border with Mexico using an executive order. According to The Times, the proposal amounts to a sweeping use of presidential power to fortify the border and impose the kind of aggressive immigration restrictions and enforcement measures that Mr. Trump has made his signature pursuit. The plan is expected to prompt a swift challenge in federal courts. Earlier this week, there were reports of 800 to 1,000 U.S. troops being readied for the border to meet the caravan. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen said on Fox News on Thursday night, "We do not have any intention right now to shoot at people, but they will be apprehended, however." Later on our show today, we'll get an update on the caravan with Jose Artiga of Share El Salvador. We'll also discuss the current human rights situation in Honduras, which the U.S. is partially responsible for and which is driving the refugee crisis. General Motors has said it will propose setting a single emissions standard for vehicles to the federal government. It also wants the government to mandate that a certain percentage of all vehicles produced by a company be zero emissions cars. Mark Russ, a GM executive, said a national zero emissions program will drive the scale and infrastructure investments needed to allow the U.S. to lead the way to a zero emissions future. GM will make the proposal as part of the written comments being accepted by the Trump administration on its plan to roll back Obama-era vehicle emissions standards. The company cited it would be cheaper to have one standard than a patchwork of standards for cars, referencing California's tougher requirements. And finally, Google on Thursday announced that it had fired 48 employees over the past 2 years over sexual harassment accusations, and that those employees were let go without severance packages. The announcement was in response to a New York Times story published hours earlier called "How Google Protected Andy Rubin, the Father of Android." The Times article details how the internet giant paid Mr. Rubin $90 million and praised him while keeping silent about a misconduct claim. And that does it for our headlines today. Stay tuned.
KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump and the White House staff have rushed to express unity and denounce the acts of potential violence related to suspicious packages being sent to a number of people around the country this week. On Wednesday, Trump read a statement to the White House saying federal law enforcement was on the case, but the strong pattern that has emerged from the pipe bombs and envelopes of white powder is that they're all aimed at people Trump has spent years attacking, vilifying, and encouraging violence against. former President Barack Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, CIA Director John Brennan, and current House Representative Maxine Waters, and even actor Robert De Niro. The package aimed at Brennan was delivered to CNN's New York office. CNN has also been one of Trump's favored targets. Right-wing media have jumped to turn the tables on the story, claiming that conservatives are the ones targeted for violence, and even going as far as implying that liberals were behind the incidents in order to undermine the GOP's midterm election chances. My guest is Julie Milliken. She's the Vice President of Media Matters for America. Welcome to the program, Julie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So obviously this is something that we shouldn't be terribly surprised by. Trump has spent a very long time, even from before he was president, bashing many of the figures that are the targets of whoever this person was. Why do you think people aren't more strongly drawing the line? They're not. I haven't seen the term terrorist yet, but essentially a threat of violence intended to have a political repercussion. It's considered a terrorist act, right?
I would think so, yes. I think there's a lot of people in the mainstream media, at the very least, that seem to be trying to withhold judgment until more is known about the motives of the person who sent these bombs. I don't know why we need to really wait that long, to be perfectly honest. The motive seems to obviously have some sort of a political association to it, given who has been targeted. And additionally, we're looking at people who are repeated, as you mentioned, targets of like the president himself. They're repeated targets of the right-wing media. Clearly, that's not a coincidence that these people were chosen. Now, why exactly the person who was sending these bombs, decided that they wanted, what their precise motivation was behind sending it, of course, we don't know yet. But it's obvious that there's a linkage there between the fact that these people are frequent targets of the president and of the right-wing media apparatus that supports him.
Even if it turns out that the person isn't a Trump supporter, shouldn't some responsibility lie with Trump, given that he has singled out, not just as a candidate, but as president, singled out so many high-profile figures by name, such as the former president of the country, such as Hillary Clinton, his former candidate and Secretary of State, Maxine Waters, a sitting House representative. He's insulted them. He has belittled them. He has, in many ways, almost given a tacit go-ahead to his supporters to do the same. And it wouldn't surprise anybody if a deranged supporter took that one step further.
Right. And I totally agree with you 100%. It wouldn't be surprising at all to find out that this was indeed a Trump supporter. We don't know that. It could be somebody who was trying to use the Trump attacks as a way to distract from some issue, and I highly, highly doubt it. There's obviously a relationship there between how Trump has repeatedly gone after these people and why these people specifically were the ones targeted. And I don't know why we're not saying as a country that our president should be held to a higher standard here, that he should, with all of his lectures about civility, he should be the one who is responsible for rising up and rising above and toning down the rhetoric and toning down the rhetoric of his supporters and urging them to be more responsible with their criticisms. It's nobody saying you can't have disagreements with somebody from a different, who has a different political viewpoint than you, that you guys can't talk about those disagreements, that you can't campaign on those disagreements. That's 100% what our democracy is all about. But there should be some responsibility that you shouldn't be using things to fan flames of racial tensions, that you shouldn't be targeting people, villainizing people, making people, not just like individuals, but also looking at like blaming the media for causing this environment in which, Trump supporters are so outraged that they feel like potentially they need to send pipe bombs to, Trump's political enemies.
Right. And for our TV audience, by the way, we're playing a mashup of all of the times during his presidential campaign, 2015, 2016, that Trump very explicitly and overtly talked about knocking the crap out of people, wanting to punch people in the face, offering to pay the legal fees for somebody else who was punching a protester at one of his rallies. I mean, he's physically making the, you know, showing the punching action, and then his supporters are mimicking him. I mean, this is like, this is his, modus operandi.
Right. Right, exactly. And it's not even, you don't even have to go that far back. I mean, look, it was just last week where Trump was talking and supporting a representative, I forget his name, but the representative who assaulted a journalist last year, in 2016, and was convicted of it. He was in Missouri.
Greg Gianforte.
Yes. Gianforte, thank you.
Right, Greg Gianforte assaulted a reporter for the Guardian newspaper, right. Body slammed him, and Trump said he went to for his re-election campaign rally and said that he liked the idea of supporting a guy who could body slam a reporter.
This was just last week. And the Trump crowds constantly, still 2 years later, every time Hillary Clinton's name is mentioned, is just screaming, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up. He encourages this. Anybody who denies that he encourages this is just being disingenuous and just lying.
And we know that Trump supporters are vehemently loyal. They are so loyal that in the face of Trump's lies, overt open lies, they back him no matter what, which, you know, led him to say, I remember during his campaign, he could go out and shoot someone in the street and his supporters would still back him. So they are so loyal, they naturally will mimic what the president does. There was just another incident that took place on Southwest Airlines. I don't know if you saw this, Julie, where a man was arrested for groping a woman on an airplane flight. While she was asleep on the flight, he grabbed her breast. And then when he was arrested, he literally said, the president says it's okay to do this.
Right. Right. So is it such a shock to think that this that President Trump could have whipped up one of his supporters into such a frenzy that they took it seriously and then they sent, you know, pipe bombs to threaten people that Trump routinely targets? No, I don't think that's a stretch at all to say that that's entirely possible, and that Trump, the rhetoric that Trump and the right-wing media apparatus that supports him routinely engages in, easily could lead to this type of behavior.
Now, I want to highlight the exchange between CNN and White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. CNN spokesperson, he's actually the worldwide president of CNN, Jeff Zucker, said there is a total and complete lack of understanding at the White House about the seriousness of their continued attacks on the media. The president and especially the White House Press Secretary should understand their words matter. Thus far, they have shown no comprehension of that. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, tagging President Trump, replied, said that Trump asked Americans to, quote, come together and send one very clear, strong, unmistakable message that acts or threats of political violence of any kind have no place in the USA, yet you chose to attack and divide. America should unite against all political violence. She turned it around on CNN, I don't know how, found a way to blame them, and I understand Trump is doing the same thing. They're still blaming the media.
And they're expert gaslighters. That's what they do. Yeah. And they are not alone in that. Actually, one of the things that we first observed in the right-wing media response as it unfolded, as the news was breaking on Wednesday, that these pipe bombs were being discovered, was that the media, they went a couple different routes. There was a group of right-wing media's people, figures who are like more on the far right, you know, the Laura Loomers of the world, Michael Savage, who's a far right, right-wing video host, Rush Limbaugh. They were starting the false flag narrative, for instance. So there was one idea that like, this can't be real. This is just a false flag to distract from the migrant caravan that we want everybody to talk about and the violent left and how they're coming and bringing people to invade this country and steal the election, et cetera, et cetera. Because that has been the narrative that the right has been pushing with Donald Trump's full support for the last week. And then the other narrative that we saw emerge pretty quickly were people who were trying to turn it around and say, well, you know what, really the reason why this happened is because it's the Democrats' fault in the first place. And then they would specifically attack Maxine Waters, Eric Holder, Hillary Clinton for comments that they had made and that the far right and the right-wing media were taking completely out of context. About civil disobedience and protesting, Trump administration figures, Trump policies that they disagree with, and like wanting to fight back against like the toxicity and divisions that we're experiencing by the GOP. They turned that around and said, you know what, like you guys were calling for incivility. You created this, environment in which people were going to get all riled up. It's really your fault. We're the victims here.
Wow.
We're the ones that are always like subjected to your hatred. And they were very quick out of the gate with that.
Trump himself on Thursday, I want to actually quote his tweet. He said, a very big part of the anger we see today in our society is caused by the purposely false and inaccurate reporting of the mainstream media that I refer to as fake news. It has gotten so bad and hateful that it is beyond description. Mainstream media must clean up its act fast. He didn't mention the suspicious packages, but clearly that's what he's alluding to it when he's saying a very big part of the anger we see today. Unbelievable and so Orwellian. Up is down, right is left. You know, this is just in his world. The sun rises in the west,
right? And it's so, if you pair that with the fact that on Wednesday night, as this is all still unfolding, he held a campaign rally. Mm. And at the campaign rally, he started to blame the media again, while he was supposedly calling for civility and for both sides to come together and for people and decrying, you know, these acts of violence. He immediately pivoted to blame, you know, the media for being unfair.
And at that same rally, that rally began with chants of lock her up, aimed at Hillary Clinton, right?
Of course it did. I'm sure it did.
Yeah.
I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So this whole phenomenon has, it seems like, completely escalated a very volatile moment that we're living in, Julie. And when you have a president and a party and supporters of this president and party who are so intent on sidestepping blame for inciting violence, what can we do? Because telling the truth doesn't seem to matter anymore. Pointing out that it's Trump who's inciting violence and it's his supporters that have beaten up protesters, and in the name of Trump, people are saying and doing so much damage. Pointing it out doesn't seem to matter.
Right. I know. And as a media watchdog organization, it's one of the most frustrating things is that the facts don't seem to matter anymore. One of the things that we try to do is make sure, at the very least, that this sort of toxic narratives that the right is pushing is not being adopted uncritically by the mainstream press. They can have a tendency to just transcribe what it is that Trump's saying without pushing back. For instance, like we saw several headlines. I was looking last night, I was on Twitter after the rally and noticed that many of the tweets that were coming out from these organizations were just, their headlines were focused, Trump chastises media for the pipe bombings, or attempted pipe bombings. And it was just so unfair the way that they were describing what was happening, because it was just privileging this gaslighting that he was doing. Right. It was privileging the fact that they are trying to shift the narrative. They're trying to flip everything on its head and say, no, really, it's your fault that this is going on. The things that we do, we are not responsible for at all because you made us do it. It's really hard to operate in an environment like this right now. I would say as individuals, people need to find their own ways of pushing back and fighting back. Certainly as individuals, people can take a look at what's happening, in the election cycle and make decisions for themselves about who it is that they would like to support. And that's one way that people can fight back. But, you know, from a media watchdog perspective, one of the things that we need to do is really try to contain and draw and shine a light on what it is that they're doing and say, don't fall for this. You know, don't allow them to flip the script. Don't be afraid to continually push back. Because there are people that are listening. I mean, now, yes, we're not going to get to Trump supporters that way, but there are people who understand what's going on here.
What you were saying seemed to imply that even the mainstream press, unfortunately, far too often gives Trump way too much attention. Every time Trump speaks at a rally, because he's so crazy, he gets the news attention. But, you know, there are Democrats, there are non-Trump people speaking out at political rallies. They may not be saying crazy things, and so they are simply not generating the headlines. What can the CNNs, New York Times, and other, you know, media outlets, as well as what can progressive media outlets like us do? Because on the one hand, Trump is news, but on the other hand, he knows he's news, and so he's so good at manipulating that attention. Would you be able to suggest some alternative coverage?
One of the things that I would just suggest in general is to try to be mindful of not getting distracted by Trump's shiny objects. So he is very, very good at leading the media down a narrative path that he wants them to follow. You'll see that with the caravan coverage over the past week, the migrant caravan coverage. That was something that was entirely generated through right-wing media, got picked up by Trump. They thought that this would be great for them as a midterm election issue. It would rally up their base. So they went all in on it, and then the media followed. We showed, when we tracked how much time, it started with Fox News, but then as soon as Trump grabbed a hold of the issue, CNN and MSNBC also jumped right in and started covering a story that, it's not to say that this isn't a newsworthy story, but it's certainly not the top story. It's certainly not the top story in a midterm election year where all of the polls are saying that people care about pre-existing conditions, they care about healthcare coverage. And that is simply stuff that we are not seeing the media reporting on. Broadcast News, for instance, hadn't spent for the entire year, they hadn't done a single report on healthcare for the entire year up until, I believe, late last week. That's astonishing. And so these are the types of things. If you go and just follow whatever it is that Trump is trying to lead you to, you're going to miss stories that matter to people, stories that are relevant. Even if you try to cover the stories that Trump wants you to cover in a responsible way. For instance, when you're talking, again, going back to the migrant caravan coverage, CNN and MSNBC did not cover it the same way that Fox News did. It's not that they were down, you know, out there demagoguing, like having people down on the borders. I mean, Fox had Griff Jenkins, like, literally camped out with Border Patrol, like trying to bust people crossing the border illegally. CNN and MSNBC were trying to contextualize it. They had people, you know, who were embedded with the migrants. They were talking to them. They were explaining the situations. They were pushing back on the lies that Trump and others in the right-wing media were feeding about these people and what they were doing, pushing back on this idea that there was ISIS terrorists involved, that there was all filled with criminals, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's good. The thing is, that doesn't also mean that you have to, like, because this is the story that the right wing is talking about the most, that doesn't mean that that has to be the story that you're talking about the most as well. So I would say that this one, you know, narrative kind of illustrates the two different things. One is, don't always follow Trump's lead and assume that just because they're all talking about it and they're screaming about it, that means that this is a huge story that you should be taking it seriously.
Well, Julie, right after this interview, we're covering the migrant caravan, but okay. Focusing on the human rights abuses within Honduras as one of the pressures on them. Julie, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and give out a website for Media Matters real quick.
We can see all of our work, many of those studies that I referenced and more at Media Matters for America, www.mediamatters.org. And you can also follow us online, Facebook, Twitter, and we have an Instagram page now as well.
Awesome. We'll link to that. Thank you so much, Julie.
Thank you.
Julie Milliken is Vice President of Media Matters for America. We've been discussing the suspicious packages, some of them containing pipe bombs discovered around the country aimed at Trump's favored targets. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo. Thank you. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The thousands of migrants heading to the United States in a caravan are still hundreds of miles from the border with Mexico. The numbers swelled from 2,000 when the caravan first commenced from Honduras to more than 7,000 in Mexico. But now, as fatigue and sickness sets in among the many families that are traveling, some with children, the numbers are reportedly dwindling. Still, President Donald Trump, who has sought to make political hay of the caravan ahead of the midterm elections, has reportedly ordered 800 troops to the U.S. border. He has repeatedly blamed the Democratic Party for the migrant caravan with no evidence and made no mention of the fact that Republicans have controlled all three branches of government for 2 years and failed to pass immigration reform laws. He also hasn't mentioned anything about the U.S. role inside Central American nations that creates conditions that drive refugees out of there. He has referred to the caravan as a national emergency. We turn now to Jose Artiga, executive director of Share El Salvador. He's a co-author of a new report on human rights abuses in Honduras. We had had him on earlier this year when he had just returned from a trip to Honduras. Welcome back, Jose.
Thank you.
So first, let's talk about what's actually happening within the caravan of migrants. This is a caravan organized by the group Pueblo Sin Fronteras. It's a second one this year. This one's much larger than the first. As far as you know, what is the current status in Mexico of the caravan in terms of numbers, how people are doing, how far they are from the border with the U.S.?
Well, this is an accumulation of people that, you know, have been leaving Central America, especially Honduras. And when they heard that there was a caravan, they decided to join for safety. But it's the hundreds of people that are leaving in a daily basis. The caravan offers some safety in numbers. It's not the same to face, you know, a police checkpoint by yourself than to face it, you know, with several hundred or several thousand people. So they decided to join and move north. Perhaps the surprise is, you know, how many people decided to join. You know, people that perhaps were on the way or people that were thinking in leaving and decided to do it together. But this is something that is happening in a daily basis. This is nothing new. Perhaps many in the caravan don't have a clue that there are elections in the United States. You know, they are just living conditions that are exhausting them. You know, when you try to find a job, you know, when you try to protest, they face repression, they face persecution, and it's more like policies that are expelling them, policies that are telling them, you are not welcome here, you know, get out. And then in the other side, in the U.S., they face the same policy that said, we don't want you here. So it's it has the components, you know, for a major crisis in the making.
Let's talk about the report that you co-authored about the conditions inside Honduras. This is an aspect of the story that's certainly never mentioned by politicians, certainly never mentioned by President Trump, rarely mentioned even in our media coverage. The name of the report is The Struggle for Human Rights and Transformation in Honduras, a Faith Delegation's Observations. You were part of that Faith Delegation. What are the conditions within Honduras, which is where the caravan originated, although it's now passed through and accumulated people from elsewhere as well? What are the conditions within Honduras that have led to this exodus?
We were there in May with 13 religious leaders from the United States and visit people that have been detained, people that in the January inauguration of the president went to the streets and protest, you know, like we do it here in the United States when we don't like our president. They went to the street and they were captured and detained in conditions of, you know, torture, being incommunicado. You know, some of them were for 15 days, you know, in a room with no no food or, you know, a very, very difficult condition. So we went and visited them and asked them, you know, why are you being detained? You know, why are you being persecuted? And they said, well, because we don't like this government, and we went to the street. In some cases, people were detained, you know, because they were the leader of the town. And so we took testimony, you know, and one after another one, they were very unhappy with the conditions. Some of them could be facing, you know, 10, 20 years in jail. So we expressed our solidarity, and we took notes, you know, we took notes and wrote the report, which is asking for stop, you know, persecution to people that are expressing their opinions on the street.
So there's multiple factors, it sounds like, that have driven people out of Honduras. And a lot of this is related to the political situation there with the recent elections that took place, and going before that to the U.S.-backed coup against the government of Manuel Zelaya. How much responsibility does the United States government bear in fostering these conditions?
I would say a lot of responsibility, because the elections that happened last November, the United Nations, the Organization of American States, doubted the results. You know, people said, you know, this is the counting of the votes, you know, was challenged by many. But the United States decided to endorse the results and kind of impose this person that technically should not have been elected, because the Constitution does not allow for one person to run a second term. So from the get-go, he was illegitimate. And then not only was not supposed to run, but he didn't win the elections. So by imposing this person, it kind of provoked, you know, a lot of demonstrations, a lot of unhappiness. And the response from the government was repression. You know, you go to the street and you will be persecuted. We witnessed that when we were early in the year in January, where peaceful demonstrations will be attacked, you know, by the police. Young people will be chased and then put in jail. So when the United States, you know, is endorsing something that is illegitimate, something that is illegal, this is the result. You know? And then when you go to the countryside, when you go to the communities, you see the level of poverty. You know, even though the United States is sending aid, that aid is mainly for military purposes. It's not addressing simple things like education, you know, health, and creation of jobs. So people are desperate. You know, when you see a family with two or three children, you know, deciding to leave, you know, that is dramatic, because it's not a secret that the route of Guatemala and Mexico to the U.S. is extremely dangerous. So when you decide to leave the conditions in Honduras, it means that those conditions are worse than the route north.
It's incredible, because to undertake a journey like this on foot across countries, thousands of miles, knowing that you're going to be met with troops at the border, being preyed upon by, you know, criminals. It is obvious desperation that is driving these folks northward. And yet Donald Trump has described this almost like an invasion, calling it a national emergency, as if these are people that are coming to endanger Americans here in the United States, when most likely these will be part of a labor force that the U.S. relies on. Most likely these people would be, you know, people who contributed to the tax base of the United States. and are hoping to find a safe and decent life. What do you make of how much political traction Trump is attempting to make of the timing of this caravan? And do you think it's having an effect here in the United States? Because recent polls have shown Republicans are, count, quote, illegal immigration as one of the top issues that drives them to vote for Republicans.
Well, I think, that there are differences between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, but it was Obama and Hillary that endorsed the coup in 2009.
In Honduras,
In Honduras. They were the ones that says, let's remove a democratically elected government and impose this other one. The Trump administration is
so, more aggressive. So when Trump lays the blame for the current crisis at the Democrats' feet, he doesn't, of course, mean that the U.S. backed a coup in Honduras, but in a way, what he's saying touches on the truth inadvertently.
it's a little bit, imposing or implementing similar policies that are being implemented in the U.S., now in Honduras. So rich people don't pay taxes. The government does not address the needs of the people. Here in the U.S., there's creation of more poor people or people that will not be able to access health and this or that. In Honduras, because they were already poor, when you apply the same formula, you create an explosion. So when you see the numbers, I think the call is to the people of faith, to the human kind in the United States, to say this is a big problem. We want your help. We want you to pay attention. And I think that the caravan has done that. This is not the first one, and it's not going to be the last one. Perhaps with the kind of policies that are being imposed, we might see millions of people leaving Central America. You do not see people leaving Bolivia. You do not see people leaving Ecuador, which are poor countries, but governments there are kind of developing policies that maintain, some level of living wage, if you want. But you see it from Central America. The companies are coming. And let me give you one example. If you live in the coast, in the Atlantic coast, you are a Garifuna, this African descent, beautiful people that have been there for 200 years. Now you have these big corporations coming to develop tourism. And they say, you need to remove everybody from the area because these beaches are heavenly, beautiful, and we want to develop, this resort. When you move those people, there is nowhere to go. Same thing when you are with the palm oil, where they are planting billions of trees, and they need to remove the people. So the policies are displacing people. So where do you go?
Right. So there's so it's not a mystery why people are leaving. It's very easy to identify these very clear policies, corporate-driven policies, governmental policies. And I'm so glad you brought up the point that there are countries in Latin America where people aren't leaving. And if there's a correlation with what sort of policies, whether those are people-centered policies or not. So in the report that you co-authored about the human rights situation in Honduras, what are the recommendations that you make to the U.S. government, who seems, to think that the only way to deal with migration from these countries is to build a wall on the border? What recommendations would you make to actually treat the source of the problem, the cause of the problem?
Well, the first one is to cut U.S. military aid. So when Trump says, because of the government is not doing its job, and he will go in to cut military aid to Honduras, we agree with Trump.
He specified military aid? He said he would cut aid, but I don't know if I've heard. Has he said military aid?
Most of the aid is military.
But he may not be saying that because he might be relying on people's ignorance and think that we're just sending, aid to these countries that's benevolent. But you're right. If we did cut military aid, that would be a good start.
If we cut military aid and leave the people alone, that will be the best help we could do. Second, we need to hold accountable the democratic institutions and respect the will of the people. You know, the people did not elect this government. So this government should go. You know, and that's the demand on the street. It says, fuera Ho, you know, the president has to go. That will be the second one. The third one will be stop the persecution of the people. You know, people have the right to demonstrate. You know, people have the right to go to the street. They should not be captured yet. They should not be attacked because they are expressing. One thing that we should notice is that the people are demonstrating peacefully. Nobody's taking arms. Nobody's, you know, doing violently.
So you're suggesting the U.S. government should pressure the Honduran government to respect these rights inside Honduras.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Because otherwise, it's like a pressure that is building up, you know, and people will exploit in, you know, things that we don't want to see. You know, nobody wants violence. You know, the people themselves don't want violence. But when we corner the people of El Salvador in the 80s, you know, a war developed. And this is not only a situation in one country, it's the whole region, you know, the whole region that is in turmoil, you know. And what they want is, I mean, when you ask anybody on the caravan, say, what do you want? He said, I want a job. They are not asking for handouts or special programs. They said, we would like a job where we can use our labor to sustain our families. It's kind of simple.
In the report, you also say that the U.S. Congress could pass the Berta Cáceres Act, of course named for the slain human rights and indigenous environmental leader in Honduras. What is that act? Is that would that address the military aid aspect you were discussing earlier?
Yes, you know, the Berta Cáceres, you know, a prominent human rights environmental leader, is killed. A couple of years ago, and no investigation so far. So the law is asking to cut, you know, again, cut military aid to the police, to the military, and force the government, you know, to investigate these cases. So the U.S. is very much involved in Honduras. You know, it's very much involved, and is sending mixed messages. You know, in one hand, this administration in the U.S. is saying we don't want these refugees. We want to cut, you know, to close the border. But in the other hand, is putting them on fire, you know, and physically pushing them out of Honduras. So that's not a humane policy. It's not a policy that we as a country or as people in this country should aspire. We should reach, you know, for a peaceful coexistence with our neighbors. You know, in Central America are our neighbors.
Now, Jose, what do you expect is going to happen when these migrants that are part of this caravan reach the U.S. border? I mean, there have already been migrants coming in, sort of, you know, in the normal migration patterns have continued separate from the caravan. And for those people who arrived this summer as families, of course, we know that they were separated, parents separated from their children. Now that practice has been halted, although some children remain separated. But there's this new idea that Trump has been putting forward, the binary choice idea, where parents will be told that they can either, you know, choose to remain detained with their children or choose separation. Is that what's awaiting these migrants? Or is there something worse, given that there are going to be 800 troops on the border, it seems like?
I think this is a larger problem. It's not a matter of this caravan, you know, will they get in or not in the U.S. This is an explosion of society, and people will be leaving Honduras. They are being expelled from Honduras. So some of them will stay in Mexico if they can find new conditions there, and we hope that the new government of López Obrador will embrace some of them. Others might go to other parts of the region. Some might find a way to go into the U.S., but I think the main point is they are screaming, you know, help us. let's do it legally. You know, they have legitimate cases. So under international law, they should be able to receive political asylum. Perhaps solutions will come from other countries. You know, can, you know, Canada or can Europe or South America say, you know, we will take these mothers. So it's a call for help. And the solution is not a one-way solution. The solution might be a multi-solution. And I think that the beauty of this is that they are asking people in the U.S. help us. You know, we are calling at this very moment because we are desperate. I myself, you know, have right now a two-month-old niece. A granddaughter, and I cannot imagine, you know, carrying this baby the way they are doing it. You know? So when you see those images, the call is very powerful. You know, these are human beings. You know, these are not terrorists. These are not ISIS people. They are not violent. If you search them, nobody has a weapon or anything. These people are just escaping a situation that has been created, and the U.S. is part of that.
The images of these families fleeing and heading to the U.S. is so similar to the images of Syrian and Afghan families fleeing their war-torn and impoverished nations and trying to cross the Mediterranean to come to Europe. I mean, we're seeing these migration patterns globally, and they really should be sort of seen as connected and as, you know, desperate people trying to find a good life for themselves. But President Trump, even before these caravan migrants have entered the U.S., President Trump started calling them, quote, illegal immigrants, which of course is a very dehumanizing term. But really, technically, these are people who are coming to apply for asylum. So those are two very distinct things. When somebody crosses into the border without seeking asylum, the technical term might be illegal alien. But if you're coming to the border with the intention of applying for asylum, as you were saying earlier, this is actually enshrined in international law. Now, Trump has recently decided to embrace the term nationalist. Jose, I'm sure you saw that recently in a speech. He said, this is an unpopular term, but I'm going to say it. I am a nationalist. Isn't that a very, very disturbing sign? Isn't that a very clear indication that when you say you're a nationalist, you've basically said you don't want any part of being an international community?
Well, we live in a worldwide community. You know, the markets don't have borders, and I think the root of the problem is that a small group of people, you know, in the north, you know, a very, very small group of people, wants profits with no limits. And they arrive to a country like Honduras that is a rich country. Honduras is not a poor country, but try to steal all the resources and then leaving the locals with nothing. And that's just wrong. And that's happening all over the world. The same model is being applied, you know, in Africa and, you know, in the Middle East and in other places. Mm-hmm. So what we will see if we don't change is forcing people out of their home. So I think the call is for our humanity. You know, we as human beings, you know, cannot allow this to happen. And I think the call is, each of us can do something. You know, first, you know, start understanding what the root of the problem is, and then be part of the solution. You know, let's start a dialogue. Let's start embracing our refugees from all over the world, not only from Central America, and see them as a human beings. You know, because if we lose our humanity by ignoring them or not helping, we are victims too. You know, we will become immune to suffering, and that cannot happen.
What do you think the impact of this caravan will be on the midterm elections? As you said earlier, the people traveling in the caravan are likely unaware that there are these historic elections happening. They are simply trying to find a better life. But of course, there is an election happening. So it's a very interesting and important political moment in the United States. Democrats or people identifying as Democrats or liberals or progressives see what happened this summer in terms of the Republican and Trump-led attacks on immigrants as really inspiring them to get out and vote. Republicans have a completely polarized and opposite view because, of course, they're influenced by what their president is saying, constantly vilifying and demonizing immigrants. And as we saw, these suspicious packages and pipe bombs targeting when Trump is inspiring someone violent to take aim at Democrats, he's essentially also, his words naturally are generating probably greater hate crimes against immigrants here in the United States. So with this migrant caravan coming just days before the midterm election, will it have an impact, you think, on politics?
I think the elections, there are many factors that will impact the elections, from people that will not be able to vote, from messages, that, will confuse people. So perhaps the caravan is a component. I wouldn't say a major component, because the people that elected Trump, they were already against immigrants. I don't think that they will change further to the right. The people that see the humanity of the refugees perhaps will not change.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thirsty City, a monthly beat and rap night at the Liquor Store in Portland. On Friday, October 26th, Thirsty City hosts Los Angeles-based Mike Slott and Jansport, along with sets by Omari Jazz, Rap Class, Bravo Domo, and Slurgeon. KBOO's Northern Draw will also be DJing. Again, that's Thirsty City at the Liquor Store, 3341 Southeast Belmont Street in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Art of Fawn with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd, from 6 to 9 p.m. at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. Art-a-thon with Impact is a 12-hour creativity and wellness festival. Young people are invited to participate in groups. In 8 hours, each group will create an original artwork that is connected to themes of mental health and wellness. A festival from 6 until 9 showcases all performances and artwork, open for all to attend. Again, that's the Art-A-Thon with Impact on Saturday, November 3rd, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Agnes Flanagan Chapel at Lewis and Clark College, 0615 Southwest Palatine Hill Road in Portland. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio station. The time is 7:01, and the struggle is next.